This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. For government power brokers inside the Beltway, the investigation of lobbyist Jack Abramoff is all about the politicians who may or may not be ensnared in the web of money, lies, and bribery. Across the country, though, Native Americans wonder how this scandal will affect them. Indian tribes hired Abramoff to lobby on their behalf, and he proceeded to loot a great deal of their money. In the most egregious case, the cash-flush Coushatta tribe of Louisiana paid Abramoff more than $30 million to protect their casino revenues from competition across the border in Texas. At the same time, Abramoff took millions from the Tigwa Indian tribe to do just the opposite. Some wonder how and why the tribes got involved with high-powered influence peddlers in the first place. Others worry how they could have been taken so easily. And many Native Americans are concerned that stories about corruption and gambling will reflect badly on them all. Indian casinos bring in nearly $19 billion a year, yet many Native Americans still live in abject poverty, with an average per capita income of less than $8,000 per year. Later in the program, NPR's Tom Goldman will join us with a preview of the Winter Olympic Games. But first, lobbyists, gambling, and Native Americans. If you have questions about how the scandal affects Native Americans or about the Indian casino business, give us a call. We'd especially welcome Native Americans with firsthand observations on the effect of casinos. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. We have a new email address as of today, talk@npr.org. We begin with Jody Rave, who covers Native American issues for the Missoulian newspaper in Missoula, Montana. She joins us from the studios of Montana Public Radio there in Missoula. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thank you.
Explain to us, what did the tribes hire people like Jack Abramoff to do in the first place?
Well, one of the things is if you take tribes like the Coushatta or the Saginaw, I think they were just looking for access to Washington politicians. And if you look at that, that's a situation where tribes around the country have typically been cut out of that loop. They haven't been sitting at that table. And I think once you take these tribes that have started to make money, they started using that money to pay for access, and it's something that they never really had the opportunity to do before.
Because they didn't have the money in the business until really the Indian casino business started taking off, 20 years ago?
Correct.
In seemingly every school history lesson and public dialogue, Indians are portrayed as victims. Do Indians accept that they're being portrayed as victims again in this scandal?
You know, I think there's a lot of tribes that don't necessarily see themselves as victims. And again, you're only talking about a handful of tribes that are involved in this lobbying scandal. You have 560 federally recognized tribes in the country. A lot of the reaction that I'm hearing from people outside of the scandal, a lot of Native people, is that this is just a situation where the scandal should not reflect on them, and they don't feel that there should be criticism for the access that other tribes have had to Washington lobbyists, but it's not something that reflects the reality for the majority of tribes around the country, because half of the tribes in the United States are not operating casinos, and they are not flush with the type of gaming revenue that's making the news these days.
Yeah, many Americans, and I think particularly on the East and West Coast, seem to think that Native Americans are swimming in casino profits. What's reality like out there in Montana?
You know, the reality in Montana is what's happening with this whole casino story, and it's been brewing ever since the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act pushed tribes into greater prominence. But what the majority of Americans are seeing are tribes such as the Mohegans or the Mashantucket Pequots in Connecticut, where those two tribes alone are bringing in roughly $2 billion in gaming revenue. And you look at the California tribes, which are very, very small membership or number-based rancherias, basically. But together, collectively, they're bringing in $4.2 billion. But here in all that space in between, in states like Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, you're getting really a different picture in Montana alone, tribes, there's seven large-based reservations in the state, and in total, they've made $16.3 million in the last year. So there's a huge discrepancy in what's happening out there on the gaming front.
In terms of Native Americans, do they regard gambling industry as a net positive for them?
You know, in a lot of these situations, the casinos in Montana are so small that they're not making a tremendous impact. But, you know, on the other hand, you are creating jobs that weren't there before. Typically, what you have, you know, you mentioned let's just talk about the unemployment rate for tribal citizens in Montana. It's 66%. So anything you can do to bring a few jobs in the community are you know, very much sought after, and gaming does fulfill that role.
Let's get some callers involved in the conversation. Again, our number, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. That new email address is talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Cher. Cher's calling from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, yes. Well, here in Oklahoma, we have casinos that have recently opened up, the Cherokees and the Creek, and I'm of Cherokee descent. But my main question really was, I thought that maybe in some of the states on the East and West Coast and the smaller tribes, do they actually own their casinos outright? Because it was my understanding that there was a particular holding company of investors that originally started up the casino that probably made more of the profit and just gave the Indian tribes a cut, per se, whereas I believe in our state, the Cherokee and the Creeks own their casinos outright.
Jody Rave?
You know, there were large investors that, let's say, helped the Mashantek at Pequot. I believe they had a Malaysian investor. And tribes turned to outside investors when American investors failed to make a loan with them so they could get into the business. And as far as the agreement that they have, the operating agreement, you know, that's not really public knowledge.
Thanks for the call, Cher.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Our next guest describes the Indian casino gambling business as the least transparent industry in America. Joining us now is Fergus Bordewick. He's the author of, among other books, Killing the White Man's Indian, Reinventing Native Americans at the End of the 20th Century. And he joins us from his home in Red Hook, New York. Nice to speak with you again.
Thank you. Hello, Neil.
This lack of transparency in the industry, how far does it go?
Well, it's vast. First, bear in mind that there are only about 25, unless I'm mistaken, individuals involved in regulation and monitoring of tribal gambling operations with a budget of $14 million. When there are 228 tribes that operate something like 400 casinos in more than 30 states. The state of New Jersey, by contrast, has a regulatory budget of $70 million and 650 employees for gambling in the city of Atlantic City, New Jersey. So first, the federal government has a minuscule and utterly incapable regulatory force. Second, more broadly, once gambling revenues pass off the tables of tribal casinos, essentially, in most cases, they disappear. There is let's call it, for want of a better term, a kind of iron curtain provided by tribal sovereignty that defeats most efforts to really ascertain where the money goes.
And what would this have to do with the Abramoff scandal?
Tribal gaming has grown since the 1980s to become a $19 billion industry. The very invisibility of the disposition of gaming revenues on tribal ground has created an enormous trough for lobbyists, for lawyers, for all those who feed on gambling revenues generally, but how tribes choose to spend that money is unregulated.
So, for example, if a tribe wanted to set up a casino in the first place or find some land where that might be possible, if they have sovereignty, why do they need to get cooperation of the federal government or federal authorities?
Well, okay, this is a tremendously complex issue.
I was afraid you were going to say that.
Yeah, I'll simplify it as best I can. It requires generally a compact between the tribe and the state in which the tribe's reservation is located, but the states are required by the federal government to sign such a compact. And as the words, states have sort of a legal gun to their head.
Mm-hmm.
States that have tried to fend off these compacts have not succeeded. It is harder for a tribe to acquire off-reservation land and then convert it into sovereign territory, but there are many, many efforts to do so around the country.
And that's called reservation shopping,
as
I understand. And indeed, that would require the help of government agencies, and I guess traditionally in this country, that's involved influencing legislators.
Well, yes. I mean, the amount of money that is spent by tribal lobbyists is astronomical. In California, Native tribes became the largest single contributor to political campaigns, and they spent $70 million on one lobbying campaign in 1998, $30 million in another lobbying campaign the year afterward. They spent about one-fifth of all the money that was spent in the 2003 gubernatorial recall campaign.
Mm. Stay with us, if you would. Jody Rave, who covers Native American issues for the Missoulian newspaper, and Fergus Bordewick, who's written on these issues. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That new email address, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back right after the break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal didn't rock just Washington, D.C. Indian tribes across the country are dealing with aftershocks as well. That's what we're talking about right now. We want to hear from Native Americans in our audience today. Do you see this scandal as a sign that things need to change in the way casinos are operated and regulated? Give us a call. Our number, 800-989-TALK. That new email address is talk@npr.org. Still with us is Jody Rave. She covers Native issues for the Missoulian newspaper in Missoula, Montana, and Fergus Bordewick, author of Killing the White Man's Indian, Reinventing Native Americans at the End of the 20th Century. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Eric. Eric's calling us from Scappoose in Oregon.
Yes, thank you. Interesting subject. I was wondering, in light of the money scandals surrounding the tribal casinos, if that casts a different light on the original justification for tribal casinos. As I understand it, they were justified by saying that it was an Indian custom, and it's my understanding that there were a lot of Indian customs which certainly wouldn't be allowed, such as, well, out here in Oregon, many of the Indians practiced slavery, and, of course, there's always tobacco. I wonder, I'd like to hear your guest's response.
Jody Rave, has there been any reaction along those lines that you've seen?
You know, I have heard people talk about gambling as a traditional custom, but that's not something that, you know, permeates the conversation.
May I address that, Neil?
Yes, go ahead, please, Fergus.
Yeah, in fact, the legalization of gambling on tribal ground wasn't rooted in customer tradition. It was a Reagan era political policy designed to create some way of bringing essentially American dollars onto reservations where there was otherwise absolutely no other industry, and a way of creating some kind of income stream on reservations at a time when the party in power hoped to reduce federal expenditures.
And this was done under the using tribal sovereignty to get around state laws against gambling.
Well, the concept of tribal sovereignty is a kind of protean one that has been, frankly, invented in recent times and has been expandable or expansible since the 1980s. And it is it began as a notion of kind of community autonomy and has grown into a concept that makes tribes somewhat analogous to U.S. states. Although the rhetoric of sovereignty speaks of independent nations, as dependent as tribal communities continue to be.
You've written in the Wall Street Journal, in an age when guilt and romantic fantasy often masquerade as politics, tribal sovereignty seemed like a cure-all for the genuine wounds of the past. You think that more regulation is needed to cover
the casino
industry.
Well, I think that more regulation of gambling is needed. I mean, this whole nation has got a gambling problem. I mean, it isn't unique to tribal casinos, and it flies in the face of political logic to have a $19 billion a year industry that is, for all practical and purposes, not only unregulated but beyond view of, for the most part, the investigative press non-governmental monitoring organizations, which for all intents and purposes do not exist on or near most Indian reservations.
Jody Rave, let me ask you. I mean, there's been talk by Senator McCain and others about more regulation of gambling on Indian casinos. Is that seen by Native Americans as interference with sovereignty?
Okay, Neil, can I back up a bit?
Sure.
And I'd like to respond to the reason behind the enactment of the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, it wasn't created to help tribes get around state laws. It was created as specifically an economic development tool for tribes. It wasn't tribes that actually pushed for the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act of 1988. They had been gambling, you know, for the at least a decade before that, and that door was opened by the U.S. Supreme Court with the Cabazon Mission Band of Indians in California. So I just wanted to put that clarification in there. As far as what the Abramoff scandal means for Indian country right now and you know, perhaps Senator McCain's response to that, he has introduced legislation to make changes to the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. And I would say that the reaction uniformly across the board from tribes is that they don't want changes to that to that act. And a couple of the things that McCain is proposing is restrictions on how the Secretary of Interior can put land into trust, which would perhaps end or limit the number of tribes that are seeking to gain trust land outside of their traditional reservation borders.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks very much. Fergus Bordewick, we appreciate your time today. I know you took time out to speak with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Neil.
Fergus Bordewick is the author of, among other books, Killing the White Man's Indian, Reinventing Native Americans at the End of the 20th Century. He joined us by phone from his home in Red Hook in New York. Joining us now is Kevin Gover, professor of law at Arizona State University, former assistant secretary for Indian Affairs at the U.S. Department of the Interior. He comes to us from the studios of member station KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. And nice to have you on the program, sir.
Thank you.
Do you think it's time for more regulation of the Indian gambling industry?
You know, I do. But before we go there, there was one pretty serious misstatement that I think has to be cleared up. Mr. Bordewick indicated that sovereignty was a concept that was dreamed up somehow in the 1980s to justify this and that, including the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act.
I think he said expanded, but...
Well, but it's simply not true. I mean, Indian sovereignty in the first instance, when the United States was created, they were mentioned in the Constitution on the same level as foreign nations and states. And so it's not something that was new to American law. In fact, what has been happening, and particularly in the past 25 years, is that the sovereignty that the tribes had long enjoyed was being diminished by the Supreme Court in particular, but also by Congress and the federal executive agencies. Now, should Indian gaming be more closely regulated? Well, a couple of things. First of all, don't forget that the states play a large role in the regulation of Indian gaming pursuant to the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. Second, the tribes themselves do have very aggressive regulatory programs, and I've watched some of them in action. You know, they're not all as good as they should be, but I think virtually all of them are much better than Mr. Bordewick gives them credit for. So I just think it's unfair to say that it's unregulated. Having said that, I agree with Mr. Bordewick in two respects. First of all, I think the federal government should be more involved, not because I favor federal involvement in much of anything, frankly, but because I think it would be good for the Indian gaming industry to have that additional layer of oversight and credibility. Second, I do think the tribes should be more transparent with their finances, because otherwise all these myths arise about every Indian driving a Cadillac, every Indian being rich, and it simply isn't so. Indians remain at the bottom of the socioeconomic heap in the United States.
Mm. In general, do you think that the income from casinos is being spent wisely?
I do. Obviously, not in the case of hiring a lobbyist for $80 million over the course of a couple of years.
Well, there is that, yeah.
But in general, the changes that you see taking place on the reservations, the changes for the good, are in many instances driven by Indian gaming profits. And so, you know, when I think of Indian gaming profits, I think of clinics and wellness centers and additions to schools and after school programs, senior citizen centers. I see a lot of different things than probably many Americans who have been exposed to, as Jody Rave was saying, to the Mashantucket Pequots or the Mohegans or the small California tribes back out here in the middle of the country where so many Indians are. The picture is much, much different, and you can really see the changes that Indian gaming is causing on these reservations.
Let's get some more listeners on the line. We'll start with Michelle. Michelle, calling from Sacramento.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's nice to see Jody and hear Jody and Kevin responding to the questions. I represent Indian tribes in California as an attorney, and one of my fears with the Abramoff scandal is that there's this tribes have had the problem of negative stereotypes from the very beginning of this country. In the beginning, we were viewed as savages. In the 1700s, we were seen as less than human. Into the 1900s, you know, seen as poor and uneducated and drunken people. And in the year 2000, we were trying to raise above that and to develop economies that were strong. And gaming was one piece of that. And unfortunately, you know, some tribes have used their money in a way that maybe not be viewed as wise for the long term of their people. But I hate to see a new stereotype of corruption as affiliated with Indian people, because it is a negative stereotype that's unfair, it's unfortunate that may be the outcome of this scandal.
Kevin Gover, transparency is usually seen as the best antidote to any whiff of corruption.
I agree with that. And I what's interesting to me, first of all, the Abramoff scandal really broke because Indians on the reservations whose tribes had hired Abramoff began complaining about the amount of money he was being paid. And so there is at least that going on. And I think the tribes should be pleased with themselves that the scandal was brought to light internally before it hit the major newspapers. So that's a good sign. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that too many tribes are far too secretive about their finances. And we can understand why. Any secrets over time, so many secrets that the tribes have given up are in the end used against them. Mm-hmm. And I understand the reluctance to share information, but in an era when the tribes are self-determining, when they are self-governing, it's extremely important to be accountable to their members, at least, and to reveal that sort of financial information.
Jody Rave, let me ask you one other question, and that has to do with, working at cross purposes. These tribes, certainly in the Abramoff case, that one case we know about, were exactly hiring the same person to work against each other. But there's also these allegations of people poaching on other people's land, that sort of thing. There's no one unified position.
No one unified position as far as Indian country and their position in...
In gambling, yes.
Well, I think overall the position that Indian country would take. And it doesn't matter if you are, you know, the Mashantucket Pequots or the Northern Cheyenne in Montana. Gaming overall is supported by Indian country.
We're talking about gambling, lobbying, and big business here in Washington, D.C. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Caleb. Caleb calling from Fort Collins in Colorado.
Hi, Neil. Thank you.
Go ahead.
The thing that strikes me the most about this debate is I keep hearing the same paternalistic overtones that we've held towards the Indian nations for hundreds of years, that we're trying to do something for them in their own best interest, and therefore we need to regulate them and we need to have transparency. They are sovereign nations, and this is their money. Why can't they do what they want to do with it? If they want to spend it on $80 million to pay Jack Abramoff, it's a foolish choice, but it's their money to do it. Why do we have to step in and say we're going to regulate you for your best interests? It just strikes me as being very paternalistic and very wrong.
Kevin Gover?
Well, I don't know that anybody's talking about regulating how tribes go about hiring lawyers and lobbyists. You know, in the case of Mr. Abramoff, he broke laws that already exist, and he's admitted to that. So I don't know, I certainly don't support any additional regulation of that. When it comes to regulation of the Indian gaming industry, however, there are other interests at stake. It's not just the tribe. It's and in particular, it's the customers of the tribes who really are the ones to be protected by the regulation of gaming. And I don't think there's a case that can be made that tribes ought to be free to rip off consumers any more than any other entity that offers gambling.
But is that what we're saying, that they're ripping off their consumers and therefore, you know, they should be regulated? Because I haven't heard that.
Well, I think that's the concern. That's the justification for additional regulation. I'm with you on the idea that we shouldn't be regulating to protect the Indians from themselves. I think that's absurd and paternalistic. However, gambling, especially with the kind of money that moves around in a casino, it is important that the consumer be protected. And that's the interest that I think is worth more regulation.
Caleb, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And let's see if we can get another caller in. Nathan. Nathan calling from Lake County in California.
That's right. Thank you for having me on the show.
Sure. Thanks for calling.
It's very interesting to listen to all of what I'm hearing today, because I think most, it's certainly in our tribe, I'm a Pomo Indian, and we're, in our tribe, we feel that the gaming that has come up, especially in California, the compact that we have with the state of California is very ineffective. It is not helping members of our tribe, and we know of other tribes where very little of the money is seen by anybody. It's also very interesting for me to see, and to hear rather today, that there is so much talk about the scandal within Washington and all of the millions that have been paid off for lobbyists. The problem is not the American Indian, the Native American, however you want to call us. The problem is not that we don't have enough money. It's that we don't have a sense of being able to combine and associate with the rest of society. And gambling is one thing that is just driving another wedge in between our people and our nations and the other people here in what is now the United States. And I think that if we are going to continue with what we do and what we have in this direction with the gaming, then it is going to be even more destructive. And it has not helped the people, certainly not in my tribe, and certainly in a lot of other tribes that I know of. We don't get the money, and it's not fair.
Nathan has raised a couple of pretty big questions that I don't think we have time to answer in the next 55 seconds. Can Jody and Kevin Gover, can you stay with us over the break?
Sure.
Yes, certainly.
All right. We'll put Nathan on hold, and we'll come back with his questions after we return from the break. And again, if you'd like to get involved in the conversation, 800-989-8255 or talk@npr.org. That's the new email address. I'll memorize it soon, I promise. So we'll come back from a short break and finish up this conversation about Native Americans and gambling and lobbyists. We'll also be talking about allegations of harassment, a scoring controversy, and skiing under the influence. The Olympic Games haven't even started yet, but there's quite a bit to talk about. NPR's Tom Goldman will be joining us. And again, call if you'd like to get involved in that conversation. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're wrapping up our conversation on Indians, the Abramoff scandal, and the Indian casino industry. Our guests are Jody Rave, a reporter who covers Native issues for the Missoulian newspaper in Missoula, Montana, and Kevin Gover, a professor of law and affiliate professor of the American Indian Studies Program at Arizona State University, former assistant secretary for Indian Affairs at the U.S. Department of the Interior. Still with us on the line is Nathan in Lake County, California. And, he raised a couple of important issues about where the money goes and about Indian identity. I don't know. Kevin Gover, do you want to take a shot?
I'll take a shot. First of all, not every Indian is getting rich off Indian gaming. I think that's one of Nathan's points. Another is that in too many tribes, the tribal membership itself is not permitted to know how gaming profits are spent by the tribal government. These are governments, and like every other government, I think their books ought to be open to inspection. Now, that doesn't mean their particular business enterprises or personal information about employees, but I do think in general the tribal membership should be entitled to know how money is being spent. Then they can make decisions on who they want to elect. Having said all that, I think one of the most toxic aspects of Indian gaming is in situations where tribes are making large per capita payments to their members. Because what happens is you see kids dropping out of school, you see an increase in drug abuse and alcohol abuse, and you see people not working. They don't have to work because the gaming per capitas are so large. And that's going to be devastating in those communities over the long run. So, these are tough questions, and each situation is a little bit different, and they have to be evaluated that way.
Jody Rave, either on that point or on Nathan's other point about Indian identity.
Well, I'd like to address the issue about Nathan's comment about tribes or tribal members not seeing where the money is going. And unfortunately, I think that is probably one of the biggest issues that tribal leaders are going to have to address themselves. You know, this past week, the past 2 weeks, I've been talking with an elders committee on the in Comanche territory in Oklahoma, and they're just kind of at their end, not knowing where, $500,000 from the casino is and where it's been spent. And I think that tribes are doing a great disservice, not only to the general public with a lack of transparency, but they're creating internal strife within their own community, and they really owe it to themselves to be more accountable. I think one of the best ways they can do that is to create greater access to their tribal newspapers and perhaps give some sort of, monthly report or give reporters greater access to how they're spending the money. I think that's a simple thing to do. And if there's nothing to hide, they shouldn't have any problem making some statistics available. I think they owe it to people, especially their community members.
Nathan, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Okay. And we'll take one more. And this is Greg. Greg's calling us from Richland in Michigan.
Hi.
Hi.
We've got a real soap opera unwinding related to this here in western Michigan. Tribe A in the center part of the state has a successful casino. Tribe B out in western Michigan has been going through the process for the past 4 years or so to actually open a casino. Tribe A hired Abramoff to apply leveraged because they didn't want the competition. Now, Tribe B has hired a public relations firm to try to slam our U.S. representative for having an alleged tie to Abramoff, which obviously doesn't look like like there's any substance to it, but it just keeps getting deeper all the time.
And Kevin Gover, these questions are going to continue to come up.
Well, they are. And one of the, you know, another unhappy aspect of the growth of Indian gaming is we see this sort of conduct tribe versus tribe. And, you know, what we've got to do is sit back and say, you know, are we going to play this game now that we have some influence, now that we have some money, now that we have some political power? Are we going to play this game the way special interests do? Or are we going to maintain ourselves in a government-to-government relationship with the United States, with a different kind of relationship with the Congress than does the pharmaceutical industry or the non-Indian gaming industry, for that matter? And this sort of conduct is in my opinion, repugnant.
Greg, thanks very much for the call.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
And I'm going to thank both of our guests for staying a little extra long today. We appreciate you taking the time. Kevin Gover, a professor of law and affiliate professor of the American Indian Studies Program at Arizona State University, former Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs, joined us from the studios of member station KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. Thanks very much.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
And Jody Rave covers native issues for the Missoulian newspaper, joined us from the studios of Montana Public Radio in Missoula, Montana. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, too.
And when we come back, a look ahead at the Torino Olympics.